Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
Welcome to the show. My guest today is Brian McGrath, the Census Bureau's Chief Information Officer. My colleague Francis Rose joined me for the first part of the show. We asked Brian about his preparations for the 2020 decennial count.
Thank you for the opportunity to be on the show and share with you the exciting work that's currently in progress here at the Census Bureau, as you said, as we prepare for what will be the most technologically advanced, sophisticated, accurate, and cost-effective census in the history of the country. What I'd like to do is share a little bit with you about some guiding principles that we've put in place for how we will tackle this daunting but very exciting opportunity as we seek to count everybody in the country. So obviously there's lots of guidance around cloud, and one of our guiding principles is cloud first. We have every anticipation that we will leverage the cloud beyond our private cloud that we currently have in our data center to solve the daunting online self-response challenges, as well as many of the other systems that we will need to both put in place and scale as needed for the decennial count. Second guiding principle really focuses around mobile first, in that we know as we march down this path that traditionally folks will take a different approach and a different strategy for how they will respond to the 2020 census. And we're already seeing that with the tremendous amount of online survey work that we do today, both from the American Community Survey, but also for the several hundred million dollars worth of reimbursable work that the Census Bureau does for other government agencies. You know, we see that folks are using their mobile devices, their smartphones, their tablet devices to respond to the censuses that we currently host online, and we think that strategy will only improve. So not only cloud first, but also mobile first is really tantamount to our strategy. Next is really looking at providing the systems and capabilities through a shared services framework. And the Census Bureau has really adopted a shared first strategy where we don't look to develop isolated and stovepipe systems. We look at what capabilities can we provide in a shared services strategy, both within the Census Bureau, but also across with our other partners at Commerce and across the federal space. Excited to say that we have completed our migration to cloud email. We moved almost 18,000 email boxes and over 5 terabytes worth of data to the Office 365 cloud environment, and that work was completed as of last week. So we're pleased and we're excited to be able to leverage that technology. Fourth is around a strategy of services and APIs. So rather than building stovepipe solutions, we're looking at a systems of systems approach, and I will be happy to talk to you a little bit about some of the enterprise activities we have underway where we're leveraging services and APIs to connect systems and share information so that we can provide real-time data analysis and costing information to the senior leadership across the Census Bureau and Commerce as we embark on this daunting task to count everyone. The other is really looking at big data. So we obviously are looking at and evaluating administrative records and large data sets for how we can augment both the count and how we can identify the best means for reaching out and counting people. So we see big data as being a very significant player in our strategy going forward. And finally, I would just offer that we've taken an innovate, don't invent strategy. So there's a lot of really wonderful commercial technology and capability that exists. And we're filtering everything through a buy versus build lens. So to the greatest extent possible, capabilities, whether they be an existing system in its totality or subsets or services within a system, if we can purchase them and provide them via the cloud, that is our ultimate and most desired strategy.
Brian, you've crystallized a lot of the priorities of the administration overall in your priorities, in your guiding principles here. I want to ask you about the shared services one in particular. The common discussion about why agencies don't pursue shared services is, well, what we do is a little different than what everybody else does. I think one could argue that what the Census Bureau does is completely unique compared to everybody else across government, and yet it sounds like you're pushing more towards shared services than what a lot of agencies are. How are you finding that path to be so far, where maybe you do something a little bit different than one of the other 11 bureaus inside the agency, but you're able to find commonality in the infrastructure or the services that underpin it?
So the first lens that we look at is really differentiating what would be a common or commodity type of service from a mission specific activity. And you're exactly right. As the largest statistical agency in the world, there are some unique challenges and some unique business requirements that we in fact have. But for things and capabilities like email, for collaboration, for content management, for store and compute resources, you know, to the greatest extent possible, you know, we really think that leveraging shared services really empowers us to not only drive down costs, but I would argue really drives agility into our environment and the services that we provide. As a CIO, I'm a service provider, and I provide an array of IT services to my internal customers as well as my external customers and stakeholders. And anything that I can do to deliver those services in a more economical and cost-efficient way, but also within the context of being more agile so that I can respond to my customers' needs in a very efficient and effective way, then that's really the ultimate solution for us. Now, let's not forget security, because securing the data and the systems that we have is paramount to what we do. And we're very focused as an organization on security, and that's really the third leg in the stool of the services that we try to provide. I'd like to take a minute and just share with you one of our enterprise initiatives here at the Census Bureau, I think really goes to the heart of our shared services strategy, and that is our Center for Enterprise Data Collection and Processing. So what we have historically done is, as an organization, we've built systems and we've looked at the decennial requirements perhaps differently than we would have for the demographic surveys and the economic surveys that we currently perform. And through the SEDCAP initiative, we've really taken an enterprise shared services approach. So we've got all the great subject matter experts in the room, and we're looking at if we're counting people or we're counting businesses, is there really significant difference in those initiatives that require us to have different systems, different with different capabilities and different infrastructure? And what we're finding is there's a tremendous amount of consistency and redundancy and overlap in those systems. So, for example, we do a tremendous amount of data collection online. How can we use those current capabilities and systems to not only meet other surveys, but as a basis for moving forward for the internet self-response capability for the decennial census? At this point, it appears to hold tremendous benefit and opportunity for us to become secure, more secure, agile, and more cost-effective in the work that we do.
Another area that you laid out that I hear a lot about, but I haven't seen as much implementation yet, is the buy versus build mentality. How much of that is cost-effectiveness? We want to buy off the shelf and modify whatever we can rather than creating it new for money reasons. How much of it is trying to avoid past mistakes that have happened in previous census preparations, and how much of it is other reasons that we haven't discussed yet?
I would argue it's all of the above. So clearly, we're all taxpayers, and we need to be judicious and conscientious with the taxpayers' funds, and that is paramount. So, you know, we're conducting a return on investment analysis for each one of the capabilities and subsystems. And we're looking at, first and foremost, do we have a system that we've already built that we believe can meet those requirements? If we don't, then let's engage with industry to see what might be available and that we could implement either, again, as an entire system or perhaps a subset of a system. And we're really challenging ourselves from a business process reengineering perspective. So improving the technology or updating the technology just for the sake of improving the technology doesn't return or harvest the benefits. It's really a matter of leveraging new and emerging technologies and taking a challenging approach to our requirements and our business processes. So, for example, and I'm sure we'll talk about BYOD, you know, we've moved our enterprise from a legacy mobile device to a smartphone. And we've learned a tremendous amount across the organization on both the cost, security, and impact of that strategy. All those lessons learned that we're harvesting at the enterprise level, we're going to use to help inform our decisions as we move forward for the decennial census.
Brian, one thing that you mentioned when you talk about the build versus buy discussion, and then you talk about the ROI, a lot of agencies want to go down that path, yet they fall into that trap of, but we're a little different, we're a little more unique or customized, or we need this, we want to use, you know, most of it except for this one piece, and then that changes everything. There's a story I wrote recently about HHS and the troubles they had trying to move to a shared services for the lines of business for HR. How are you guys ensuring that you don't fall into that trap that so many others have fallen into about not letting your uniqueness overtake the need for to meet your business needs?
We certainly reach out and engage with our counterparts across the federal space. And Steve Cooper, our new CIO for Commerce, is really creating an environment where we as CIOs at the Bureau level come together and share information and challenges. And at the Commerce level, we're working through a shared services initiative and undertaking on how we can, as a Commerce department, move forward to secure both services and capabilities. But I think the real key is really challenging the requirements. You know, we live in a day and age where technology can do virtually anything and everything we can imagine, but at what cost? And for us, that's really the key. We've created a group here at the Census Bureau that reports directly to our Chief Operating Officer and Deputy Director, who's responsible for capturing, formulating, challenging, and documenting requirements. So when I talk about the program SEDCAP that we have underway, we have an independent group that's working with the business to really document requirements and understand those requirements and challenge them. And then most importantly, drawing that logical connection across the enterprise so that we look for commonality. The other challenges we need to think of within the context is 80% good enough? Do we always have to work for the 100% solution, or is 80% good enough? Also using an agile development methodology where we're delivering capability and we're getting it in front of the customer on a regular routine basis. And we run scrums in anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks where we're building software, but we do it side by side with our business counterparts, and they see what we're building and provide us that immediate feedback. So I think those are a couple of strategies that we've tried to use here. And certainly when we talk with our counterparts around the government, that's what we see other people doing as well.
The ROI piece, talk a little bit about how you're looking at those investments and saying, how do you ensure that you're getting that ROI and the return investment? How do you calculate it?
There's the traditional empirical approach where we actually try to document what it costs to build systems. And we can do that with a great degree of accuracy. But what's the value? And what's the value within business terms? We really try to take the concept of IT and delivering IT or focusing on IT is really within the context of business. So unless we can make a compelling argument that the technology that we want to invest in delivers discernible, harvestable business value, frankly, we just don't invest. We have a pretty strong governance model here at the Census Bureau. For example, the investments that I make, I have a governing board that has representatives from across the Census Bureau, all of the business areas, where they are the ones who make the decision what I invest in and how I invest in it. So if they don't see that there's return on investment for the business, then frankly, they don't approve the initiative and it doesn't go forward. The other thing we do is we follow a very strict project management methodology, and that same governing board sees and receives an ongoing status report, either a written report or actually, in most instances, a presentation on the status and health of the initiative. So they see all of the challenges, opportunities, failures in some cases, and successes of every IT project that I invest in. And they have the ability to approve it, terminate it, or modify it.
We have to take a break. My guest today is Brian McGrath, the Census Bureau's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
You've been doing a great job, so we'd like to give you a promotion.
Thank you, sir.
Your suggestion of getting a graduate degree at the University of Technology Skills Relevant to the Real World really helped me.
In fact, that's how I got this position. I also got my master's at the University of Real-Time Online Classes.
Really? The University of Perfect Learning Format for Working Professionals?
Yep, the very same university of endorsed by IEEE as a provider of quality engineering education.
The University of 100% online classes so you can learn from anywhere.
The University of professors who are industry experts.
The University of taking over your boss's job. I mean the University of professors who are industry experts.
Today, Capital College is Capital Technology University. We've improved our capabilities to prepare you with the specialized graduate degree you need for succeeding in today's technology and information science field. Sign up for a virtual info session at theuniversityof.net and learn more about Capital Technology University, the University of taking over your boss's job when it's available.
The Cloud for Government Report, sponsored by Microsoft.
New federal CIO Tony Scott recently identified three strategies to increase cloud adoption that agencies should consider. Know what you have, identify common services, and turn off or eliminate applications that won't survive a move to the cloud. With agility and flexibility as the difference makers, Scott says the benefits of cloud adoption are clear to organizations once implementation is complete. This is Jason Fornicola.
The Microsoft Cloud for Government is the perfect match for federal government services. With tools like Microsoft Office 365, Microsoft Azure, and Dynamics CRM Online, discover how the Microsoft Cloud for Government provides cost savings, rigorous security located in U.S. data centers, and hybrid capability with an integrated open platform, all from one trusted source. Become familiar with the Microsoft Cloud for Government, and you'll be prepared to move toward the future today. Visit Microsoft.com/cloud for government.
An increase in cyber threats has created a greater demand for federal agencies to increase security within their information technology portfolios. GTRI, a federal consulting and technology solutions integrator, along with EMC, lead the way in helping federal agencies with shared, consolidated, and cloud-enabled IT services. Learn how to manage and simplify your data environment with a secure, integrated storage solution for high-performance computing, sensor, and file-share data sets using GTRI and EMC. Learn more at GTRI.com.
AGA and the Performance Institute are proud to present the 2015 Government Performance Summit in Washington, D.C., May 4th and 5th. The focus, Putting Performance to Work, addresses the needs of professionals in all levels of government and the private sector who use performance information in critical organizational processes such as budgeting, resource allocation, employee motivation, contracting, and improving services. Register today at www.governmentperformance.org. That's governmentperformance.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and today I'm joined by Francis Rose, host of our in-depth program. My guest today is Brian McGrath, the Census Bureau's Chief Information Officer.
Brian, you've listed a couple of things in this conversation that are dramatic changes from the way the government in general has done things. Shared services, buy versus build, the 80% solution. What kind of change management issues have you dealt with in terms of demonstrating to your team and the people that work with your team and other parts of the agency, we're on a different path now. This isn't going to be the same way that we've always done things?
There's two key components of that. One, you have to have a seat at the table and you have to partner side by side with the business. And we have that ongoing relationship here between the IT side of the organization and the business side of the organization. The other, and I think equally important, is transparency. And as I said before, we have a governing board that has, frankly, more representatives from the business side than from the IT side. And they're the decision makers. And they have the ability to make the decisions how we invest our IT dollars here at the Census Bureau. I think those are really two key initiatives. You have to have that partnership, and you have to be transparent, because it hasn't been that long ago where the business really didn't have visibility into how the IT dollars were spent. And we've tackled that head on here, and frankly have found that it's been a very both beneficial but rewarding experience for all parties, because requirements change, we all know that, but IT having a partnership with the business and being able to explain what the impact of those changes are, and then technically being able to share how we solve problems and why we solve problems a certain way, really allows you to build that trust and respect, and you build that partnership going forward.
You made a little bit of news saying you just completed an email to the cloud. Talk a little bit about that migration. It was, I think you said 18,000 people, 5 terabytes of data. How did that go, and did it go as expected? We seem to want to say moving to the cloud is old hat now, but I think more and more agencies are still doing it, and they're still filled with challenges.
There's nary an IT project that doesn't present some unforeseen challenges. But for the most part, I am happy to share that our counterparts at NIST, as part of a commerce-wide initiative, had led a contract that we had planned to and were able to leverage to help facilitate our migration from an on-prem email solution to a cloud-based solution. I think some of the big challenges for us is that we had begun to lay the framework for this move some time ago, and we moved to a web-based email capability on-prem first to really help begin to set the user experience and user expectation. We had the benefit of our counterparts at NIST already completing their migration, and we worked very closely with them to document their lessons learned and some of the challenges and, frankly, opportunities they faced. I will tell you that we focused a lot on both security as well as network infrastructure, because one of the things we see, and I know all of my federal CIO counterparts see as well, is as you migrate to the cloud, you really have to have a network infrastructure in place that allows you to change your processing paradigm. So we had already upgraded our internet links to provide sufficient bandwidth, so we didn't have to be concerned with that bottleneck should it arise, and it didn't. We made a decision to go with OWA, Office Web App, and we went with a browser-based solution as opposed to a client-based solution. And that was driven really solely by providing a mobile experience. So we wanted our customers, whether they be on-prem or teleworking or working mobily, that they would gain the same experience. And those were really the key drivers, just aside from, you know, reducing our infrastructure on-prem as well as reducing our costs.
Give me a sense of how this opens the door to more cloud usage within Census. I mean, I want to go back to the decennial census, the 2020 census in a minute. But in the meantime, moving to email usually is the first step. And then the next comes what, from your perspective?
We made the decision, as I said, to go with Office Web App as our email solution. As part of that integrated suite, our next phase will be to migrate our SharePoint content management and collaboration framework from about 100 server on-prem environment to the cloud. And that, again, gives us some agility and reduces our costs. So if you think going forward, in 2010, the census hired about 500,000 people to go around the country and collect the data for the census. As we move to 2020, it's most likely that, A, we won't hire that many people, but the big change in requirements is we'll want each one of them to have a government email address. Think about the infrastructure that I would need to build to support 500,000 email accounts that, remember, I only need for about 2 to 3 months. So in a cloud environment, I can benefit from scaling up very quickly and then scaling down. It gives me that agility, but it really reduces my cost.
And cost is one of those things that when I talk to a lot of CIOs, is how do you figure out the pay by the drink approach? I just talked to the ODNI CIO, and they seem to have figured that out. Where are you guys with that idea of paying for usage?
Now, at this point, we've really focused on software as a service for a predominance of our cloud activities. And we have about 15 cloud initiatives underway here at the Bureau and have used the cloud pretty extensively in 2010. But, you know, the model next is to really embrace infrastructure as a service. And rather than having the cost of buying the infrastructure, and again, if you think forward for 2020, you know, we anticipate that early modeling leads us to believe that we could have 650,000 concurrent users on our website. That's a pretty significant infrastructure we would need to support that. But again, I only need that infrastructure for several months. And, you know, purchasing it on a per-use individual basis is infinitely more cost effective than me buying and building out that infrastructure myself.
Are you guys just not there yet in terms of the cost model? Is that something you guys are still working on?
We have an initiative right now where we're looking at the cost for cloud services from an infrastructure perspective. Some of the early returns indicate that it is more cost effective, but it's really a much different usage paradigm where we have to manage the infrastructure and spin it up and when we need it, but spin it down when we don't. So we're going to continue to learn. We've got a couple of pilot initiatives that we're going to experiment with in both the public and private cloud space, and we'll be much better positioned in the coming months to answer those questions.
All right, well, let's take a quick break on that note. When we come back, we can talk more about some of your other priorities and beyond the 2020 census, if there are any. My guest today is Brian McGrath, the Census Bureau's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
To effectively protect today's government networks, a strong cyber defense is necessary. Palo Alto Networks meets the cybersecurity needs of its government customers. They don't just monitor your perimeter. Palo Alto Networks' future-proof platform provides visibility, prevention, and resilience from endpoint across the heart of the network and within the data center for all threat types. To strengthen your agency's cybersecurity defense, learn more at paloaltonetworks.com/gov.
Attention, civilian federal employees. You're probably aware of your Fegley life insurance options, but did you know you can obtain economical group life insurance coverage through WAPA? WAPA is an independent nonprofit association formed in 1943, dedicated to serving the health, welfare, and financial well-being of civilian federal employees. To learn more about WAPA and their group term life program, visit WAPA.org. That's WAEPA.org. WAPA's group term life insurance product offers coverage from $25,000 up to $750,000. And through their associate member program, even your spouse and non-dependent adult children can also get group term life insurance coverage from $25,000 up to $750,000 through WAPA. By the way, they're not required to be civilian federal employees to apply for this coverage.
The WAPA group term life program is not endorsed by the federal government. Coverage is provided by Life Insurance Company of North America and is subject to insurer approval with evidence of good health. This policy contains exclusions and benefits may reduce by age.
What's the first thing you think of when you hear the word GEICO? I bet you thought of car insurance. But did you ever wonder where GEICO got such a unique-sounding name? GEICO was started over 75 years ago as the Government Employees Insurance Company. We've evolved a lot over the years and have grown to insure more than just government employees. But we haven't forgotten our roots. And that's why, if you're a federal employee, you may be eligible for GEICO's special federal employee discount on your car insurance. So now, besides a good retirement plan, federal holidays, and a job with stability, you might also qualify for GEICO's federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and other federal associations, you may also qualify. To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com. Then buy online, over the phone, or at your local GEICO office. And count yourself lucky that GEICO was started many years ago to save government employees money on their car insurance.
This hour of news is brought to you by Boeing, who with Bell Helicopter builds the transformational V-22 Osprey, the ideal solution to the Navy's carrier onboard delivery requirement. V-22, ready to deliver more for the Navy.
Spring is upon us, and we all know what that means. Baseball, cherry blossoms, outdoor festivals, and most importantly, Public Service Recognition Week. Show your support and appreciation of our federal, state, and local employees by joining us for the third annual Public Service 5K Run and Walk. It's Saturday, May 10 in Anacostia Park. You can register now at publicservice5k.com. That's publicservice5k.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and my guest today is Brian McGrath, the Census Bureau's Chief Information Officer. When we talk about cloud, how's that apply, or how do you foresee it applying to the 2020 census? You mentioned a little bit of it, you know, spinning up the emails and potential storage of 650,000 people. Where else are you looking at that where cloud would play a big role as you prepare for the 2020 census?
We're documenting the operations that will need it. At this point, there's 34 operations that will be needed to support the decennial census. We've decomposed the operations to the underlying systems or capabilities that will be needed for each one of those. So not every system and capability will have scaling requirements. But we do know, for example, that the internet self-response option will require a pretty significant scaling up and then scaling down. We're doing some modeling right now to look at what would be the peak requirements. So we've said that we would like for 65% of the self-response to come in via the internet. So if you take 65%, what does that mean from a per user, concurrent user perspective? There's really four pillars for collecting data for the decennial census. The first is internet self-response. The second is paper. We know not everyone will have the opportunity or perhaps the interest in using the internet to provide their response. We anticipate that there'll be some segment of the population that will want a form and will want to fill out the form and send it back in. The third is telephone. We know that based on experience, again, some percentage of the population will want to call someone and provide their information. And the fourth and the most costly is non-response follow-up. So for those members of the country who don't respond, we will come out and knock on their door and collect their response. So we're doing some modeling right now to understand if 65% of the people respond via the internet, what does that look like from a load perspective? What numbers then translate to paper, to telephone, and then NERFU, non-response follow-up, so that we can build and scale, architect and engineer all of the different systems that we need for each one of those capabilities and do that in such a way that we can be assured that it provides a pleasant experience.
And I imagine the way you'll set this up, at least today, is somebody will be watching the peaks and the valleys, and as the peak continues to increase, it's going to be a matter of saying, okay, we're about to hit our certain limit, 90% limit, let's move it up one more. And then as you hit that next 90% limit, maybe we'll turn it up again. Imagine that's your thought process right now.
Well, actually, the hope is that it doesn't require any human intervention, and it just will dynamically scale as the demand increases or diminishes. We're actually doing some testing. As a matter of fact, one of the early tests in 2015 in preparation for the 2020 census is in Savannah, Georgia. We also know that as we engage our communication strategy and campaign, that as people see advertisements, they drive past a billboard, they hear an advertisement on the radio, that they may be inclined to, at that time, try to respond. So we're learning a lot from these early years in simulating the work that will occur in 2020 in a real-world setting, so we can help both inform the operations from a business perspective, but equally importantly, the underlying IT.
I know you guys will have a bunch of tests coming up. How many tests do you have planned out from an IT perspective? I mean, you have the mobility, the mobile devices, you have the cloud devices, the cloud use of the cloud within the census. Do you have it all kind of scheduled out already between now and, you know, 2019 and 2020?
We started the testing in earnest in 2014 and conducted a series of operational tests. So what we're doing is we're actually testing the operational activities, and in support of those, we've implemented a series of technologies. So in 2014, we did a small test in the Washington metropolitan area. We used a variety of existing systems and capabilities. We built a mobile application that ran on a commercially available smartphone to actually do the non-response collection work in the field. And that it was very positive. We got positive responses back from the staff who used the application. We got positive responses back from the members of the community who were actually interviewed. So, you know, we're learning a lot from those activities. As I said, we started our first test in 15 effective today. There's a series of other tests that will occur throughout this year and next year, really leading up to a large-scale test in 2018.
You mentioned getting your network in shape for the move to cloud email. I imagine that these tests and these efforts that are happening now are to get your network in shape for the 2020 census as well. I mean, this is all part of that same process.
Correct. And part of the strategy is to put an architecture in place that will support those activities. So whether it's our network or it's a commercially available network, you know, we're working through that process today. We haven't made the decisions yet on technologically how we will solve the problems. It's a little bit of a catch-22 because you want to make the decision so that you can embark on your testing and execution, but at the same time, you want to wait as long as you can to take advantage of new and emerging technologies.
Brian, we talked a lot about the planning and the efforts and the testing around the 2020 census, specifically looking at cloud. But one other piece of this is obviously mobility. And you are looking at mobility on two ways, both from a Census 2020 perspective, but also internal. Talk a little bit about that effort and how does, you know, bring your own device fit into it?
We embarked on an enterprise mobility strategy about 2.5 years ago in order to support the rapid adoption of telework. And, you know, through a combination of VDI and our own private cloud, you know, we've delivered a capability that allows staff here at the Census Bureau to have full access to their desktop data and systems, both internally and externally. And the really fascinating and interesting piece is that, you know, we're using a BYOD approach for remote access. So staff for telework use their personally owned equipment. They can use the device and form factor of their choosing. And through a robust infrastructure and strategy around security, we feel we've delivered a solution that really supports a mobile workforce with a high degree of functionality and security. Over the last couple of weeks, with the weather that we've had here and, you know, the OPM's decision to close the government on one day, we saw over 4,000 people concurrently accessing our infrastructure remotely. So from a productivity perspective, you know, it has a real positive impact. We're now in the process of converting our regional offices, of which there are 6 around the country, from the traditional large fat client to our virtual desktop infrastructure. Interestingly enough, I received an email from our regional director from LA. He was on a plane at 37,000 feet, and he was had full access to his desktop, doing his work and sending me an email letting me know that he appreciated the technological capabilities that we had provided. So really, I think a new day here for continuing to improve productivity and supporting a mobile workforce.
It's little things like that, the thank yous from 37,000 feet when someone says to you, Brian, thank you. I mean, hopefully you had a good weekend after that, right?
I did, and he was nice enough to share it with, you know, a number of people on the team who had worked so hard to really put this in place, from our data center folks who built the back-end infrastructure, to our VDI engineers and desktop engineers and telecommunication folks who make it all happen, and certainly, last but not least, our security folks who played such an integral part in delivering a solution that we believe is secure.
Can you talk a little bit about how the VDI system works? Is it kind of a desktop on a stick, or is it you going through a tunnel? Just give me the basics.
We're leveraging an industry-leading commercially available product. So from my personally owned equipment at home, I establish an encrypted VPN tunnel. I enter my credentials. We require two-factor authentication in order to gain access. We've put some pretty strict controls on for access from home, so there's no ability to copy data from the virtual environment to my local device, to any type of third-party mobile stick that may or may not be put in a device. You can't even do a screen capture and capture to a file. So we've put the right restrictions in place. You know, frankly, it's not uncommon to be walking through the halls of the Census Bureau and see someone with their personally owned device sitting in a meeting, logging into VDI and having full access to their desktop. So it has been exciting. It's exciting to watch the important work that the business folks do here and how they're leveraging the technology to become even more and more efficient. So that's the part that's rewarding for us.
Was it a tough sell for your security folks? Did you have to kind of go through that process and say to them, here's how secure it's going to be, and here's all the check marks we're putting in there?
We took a little bit different approach. We embedded our Office of Information Security and government security engineers in the project day one, and we didn't tell them what we were going to do from a security perspective. We asked them, tell us what we need to do. Here's our end business goal. Tell us what we need to do from a security perspective in order to achieve that goal. And they rolled up their sleeves. They were integral members of the team, both from a policy perspective, but also from an architecture and engineering perspective. So it was a unified effort moving forward. So there wasn't, while there's always security concerns, having the benefit of their expertise embedded in the project day one was really key to success.
That's fascinating, because so many times you hear the old people trying to bolt on security after the fact, or bringing on the security folks after they've made a decision about the process, and then all of a sudden the security folks poke holes in their technology or their approach. By having them there at the beginning, there's no technology poking needed. It's going to be done the right way, it sounds like.
Like I said, they were involved from day one. They were involved in virtually every meeting, understanding the business requirements, the technical security and performance requirements. And they helped us bake security into the systems development lifecycle from day one. So you're exactly right. We didn't get to the end of the project and then kind of throw the system over the fence to the security folks and say, tell us everything we did wrong. They helped us identify and solve the problems day in and day out.
All right, well, let's take a quick break on that note. And we come back, we can talk more about some of your other priorities. My guest today is Brian McGrath, the Census Bureau's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Here's Frank Konechny, Chief Technology Officer, U.S. Air Force, on the Federal Executive Forum on Virtualization and Data Center Consolidation, sponsored by Brocade Federal.
We see that in terms of security, availability, reliability, and especially resiliency, the ability to switch between data centers as you need to automatically. We always talked about the automation. We want to make it just as easy to dial a phone number as it is to bring up a cloud service and move your apps around.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Think big. Break the network status quo and start now at the 4th Annual Federal Forum 2015. Join government and IT innovators as they share how to begin the path to the new IP, an emerging network foundation for innovation. New this year, a technical track designed specifically for network, systems, and storage engineers. The 2015 Federal Forum, presented by FedScoop and Brocade, June 17th at the Renaissance Hotel downtown. Register now at federalforum2015.com.
I'd like to get some info on your credit cards, please.
Mumbo jumbo, mumbo bumbo jumbo, yada yada yada, disclaimer, fee, fee, fee.
Excuse me?
Blah, 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 boo, 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 beep, jibber, jibber, jibber.
Want a straight answer? Welcome to State Department Federal Credit Union. Get an SDFCU EMV Visa Platinum card with rates as low as 6.99% APR, plenty of rewards, and no balance transfer fees. Go to sdfcu.org. State Department Federal Credit Union. Straight answers. Happy banking.
APR equals annual percentage rate, rate based upon evaluation of applicants' credit, federally insured by NCUA.
Today's Human Capital Management Report, brought to you by Graduate School USA.
More veterans were hired into civilian federal jobs than ever before in 2014, making up 33% of all new hires. That's up from 31% the year before, according to the President's Council on Veterans Employment. At the Pentagon, that number is even higher. 54% of all employees hired in 2013 were veterans. The Council is also taking steps to further integrate women and minorities into hiring efforts. Government-wide, more than 607,000 veterans work for the federal government.
Grow your skills with the leader in federal HR. Graduate School USA's Certificates of Accomplishment in Human Resources focus on the real issues that confront today's HR practitioners and managers. The Level 1 certificate is fully available online, helping you maximize your budget and your time. Visit graduateschool.edu to learn more about Graduate School USA's HR curriculum and their expert training in a full range of government specialties. That's graduateschool.edu.
Profile America, Thursday, April 9th. For much of history, a cooked meal was followed by the drudgery of scrubbing the pans used to prepare it. But something was discovered this week in 1938 that changed all that. A solidified refrigerant gas that we now know as Teflon. Developed by Roy Plunkett of the DuPont Company, slippery Teflon revolutionized cooking utensils in the 1960s. By the time he died in the early 1990s, most new cooking pans in the nation were coated with his invention. Today, Teflon is used in everything from semiconductors to communications cables and even clothing. The nation's 13,300 chemical manufacturers employ almost 750,000 workers and generate annual sales of nearly $800 billion. You can find more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
The Boys and Girls Club's highlights with Renthia Ross, VP Geico. Butler Wyatt takes a whole child approach to elementary education. Teachers, administrators, counselors, and support staff work together to meet the intellectual, social, behavioral, and emotional needs of 120 children ages 8 to 18. You can help make sure the Butler Wyatt Clubhouse stores stay open. Donate today at www.aplaceforthekids.com.
Follow Federal News Radio on Twitter for the latest breaking news and developments in the federal community as they happen throughout the day. Find us at Fed News Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and my guest today is Brian McGrath, the Census Bureau's Chief Information Officer. A lot of times when you talk about BYOD, the question comes in, are you subbing out the government-furnished device for the BYOD? And then is there cost savings? Is there cost avoidance happening? Talk about that for a little bit, and then let's talk about the 2020 census and how it relates back to mobility.
You know, when we started down this VDI path in support of telework, you know, we had done some initial cost estimates of what it would cost the Census Bureau to provide 10,000 laptops in order to support the traditional model. And frankly, it was cost prohibitive. What we also began to realize was it didn't do a whole lot for us to improve the security posture. You know, again, we talked earlier about agility and cost savings. That was really the strategy. How do we deliver and support this capability without compromising security, but really doing it in an agile and cost-effective way? As we move forward in our planning for 2020, and in 2010, we hired about 500,000 people. So if there is a way that rather than buying 500,000 devices, that we could leverage bring your own device, there's pretty significant cost-saving opportunities there for us. So even things as simple as training, if you bring your own device, and from a training perspective, all I have to do is push an app or a series of apps in a secure container that's encrypted to your personally owned device, I don't have to teach you how to use the entire device. I just have to teach you how to use those applications. So if we can take one day off the training curriculum for 500,000 people, it's 500,000 days worth of training and corresponding cost savings for the government. So we think that's significant. Now, as we march down this path of evaluating BYOD, first and foremost is security. At no time are we going to sacrifice the security of the systems or the data in order to achieve a goal of BYOD. But preliminarily, some of the cost analysis that we've done is if we could get 75% of the field representatives to use their own personal device, we think we can save about $200 million. We think that's sufficient savings that's worth us exploring. And in 2014, we did some testing. So we issued government devices, but we treated them as though they were personally owned devices. So we built an application. As I referenced before, the name of the application was Compass, and it was used to collect the data in a non-response or field activity scenario. We were able to successfully push the application to the device. We required two-factor authentication in order to get into the device. The application and data was encrypted on the device. It was double encrypted in transit to our infrastructure here at the Census Bureau, and then it was encrypted again once we received the data. We learned a tremendous amount. As we move forward for our planning in 2015 and this year for our activities for our test in Maricopa County, Arizona, once we finish the field work, we're actually going to bring back about 100 field representatives and do an actual BYOD test where we will, in the truest sense of the word, use personally owned equipment. They'll use their personally owned equipment. And we'll push the application to their device. We'll encrypt the application. We'll encrypt the data. We'll double encrypt the data as it transits back to our infrastructure. And then we'll encrypt it once we receive it here. So we think there's a lot to be learned. And we're looking forward to learning those lessons.
You talked about two-factor authentication a couple times. In the government, when we talk two-factor authentication, my first thought is always, you know, HSPD-12, the PIV cards. I understand you can't give out, you know, 500,000 PIV cards. So how are you doing two-factor authentication? Are any thoughts yet about, for instance, derived credentials and the like?
We require the HSPD-12 card to gain access internally. So as I sit at my desk, I have to put my card in a reader, and I use that two-factor authentication to gain access. Remote access, we're using an RSA token. But interesting, we've had a number of meetings with our counterparts at NIST, as well as just some great exchanges with our counterparts at DISA around the concept of derived credentials. We've done some testing of the derived credential, and it looks very, very positive. And our plan would be to roll that capability for our non-decennial field work out in 2016.
All right, very cool, because I know there's a lot of focus on drive credentials. I know that, you know, GSA is looking at this from a government-wide perspective. So obviously, if you guys are finding success, that's good news all around. The other thing you talked about relates both to this 2020 census, but also to your priorities is big data. You hear that a lot throughout the government. Talk about how you are using big data tools, doing the analysis, because there's no bigger data effort than the census.
We have access to a number of administrative data sets through the laws that empower us to do so here at the Census Bureau. We're always looking at our opportunities to use additional big data sets to improve both the execution of our business, but the products that we deliver. A significant component of the research that my counterpart on the business side of the decennial census, Lisa Blumerman, is focused on is using, you know, administrative records and big data. So how can we improve our processes through the use of big data? How can we improve the quality of the census by using big data? And those are all questions that we're trying to answer at this point. You know, we're heavily involved in the research aspect right now. We're learning a lot of really great lessons that we have every confidence will help us improve the, not only reduce the cost, but improve the quality of the decennial census, but frankly, other surveys that we conduct here at the Census Bureau as well.
All right, Brian, I know we could talk longer, but unfortunately, we are out of time. My guest today has been Brian McGrath, the Census Bureau's Chief Information Officer. Brian, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for the opportunity to share the exciting work we're doing here at the Census Bureau.
I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you've been listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.